This is a program about people, real people. You know, lots of folks say people are no good. They've made a mess of things here on Earth. They're not smart enough to live here happily together. Some say it's all bad. They say we're going to rack and ruin. We'd better dig down deep and hang on tight and maybe do or die. That's not much consolation, but there's an atom of truth in what they say. So, what do we do? Well, most folks are digging down and hanging on to what they've got in their corner of the earth. Around here, they call it the American way of life. We'd like to tell the world about it, about the real people of the USA. We've got a sample of these people. Just a few hundred of them living in a village where two state highways meet in their wanderings through farmlands. We want you to know these people, how it is for them living on Main Street of a real American town in this troubled year of 1950. Here it is for the record. What they believe, what they're doing about it, what makes them think maybe folks can live happily together. We give you the people of Pulaski, Wisconsin, 900 strong. A case in point of the American way of life.
The State Radio Council presents the documentary story of Wisconsin Communities, an actual record of life in the cities and crossroads of our state, prepared from tape recordings made on the spot to bring you the real sounds and voices of our neighbors at work and at play. Now, with narrator Ray Stanley, we travel to Pulaski, Wisconsin, a village founded on the marshlands of Brown County years ago, 20 miles northwest from Green Bay. We find it on Highway 32.
That's Jim Brusky, young fellow playing the accordion. Plays the Polish song, Strong and Gay. That one's a Krakowiak, a rich mouthful of Polish K's. And look at the names along the highway. Polish names on the billboards and the mailboxes. Names like Chibowski, Goska, Karcz, Brzeziński, Kubiak, and Niedźwiecki. Take that one, Niedźwiecki. Spell it. N-I-E-D-Z-W-I-E-C-K-I. What's that? You say strange? It's foreign? Sorry, friend, you're wrong. It's strictly USA. What are any of us here but a family tree transplanted from a foreign soil? The only names of pure American origin in Wisconsin sound like Potawatomi or Sissabagama. And there's a mouthful for you. But the names on the mailboxes of Pulaski tell the story of the village and the family trees transplanted to this soil.
We've often been asked why Pulaski, Wisconsin is called Pulaski. It seems to have been because Mr. John Hoff, the real estate man, wanted to get Poles to settle in this neighborhood, and so he put pinpoints on a map that he used as advertisement, and he named one Sobieski, another one Kosciuszko, and of course the third one, a very large dot, was Pulaski.
That's the voice of the village historian, a young man in the brown robe of a Franciscan monk, Father Fulgence, staff member of the Assumption of the Blessed Virgin Mary Monastery, OFM, Order of Friars Minor. Father Fulgence presents the record, the first beginnings of Pulaski, a large pinpoint on the real estate dealer's map.
Then, because Mr. Hoff was a businessman who knew that whenever there was a church in the community of Poles, that community would grow rapidly, he advertised in Chicago and Milwaukee papers, and also in papers further east, for a religious community to come to this community of Pulaski.
How long ago was this?
This is exactly 67 years ago, 67 to 70. At any rate, he offered an inducement of 120 acres free to any community that would come to Pulaski and establish a church. And our founder, Brother Augustine Zeitz, was enticed by that inducement, and he came to Pulaski and then decided to build, first of all, a monastery, then to build a church, and in that way to give the foundation for our present very thriving community.
So it was then that the village began. Began with a Franciscan monk who came to Pulaski and founded there a monastery and a church, even according to the gospel. In the beginning was the Word. and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. All things were made by him. In him was life, and the life was the light of men. Those are the voices of the monastery choir, directed by Father Kalinowski. A choir of boys, young men, 18, 19 years old, serving as novices in the monastery which was founded alone in the lonely wilderness before the people came. Because the church was here, the people followed, God-fearing people who wanted their church. That was the beginning of the American way of life. In him was life, and the life was the light of men, the true light, which lighteth every man that cometh into the world. But back to our historian. Father Fulgence is speaking to us in the printing plant of the monastery, a large, well-equipped printery publishing a wide range of church literature and offering apprenticeships to boys who want to learn the printing trade. Father Fulgence is busy, but not too busy, to tell us this story of how Pulaski began.
Well, as soon as they heard that there would be a church in Pulaski, they moved over from Hofa Park to Pulaski proper.
It was a hard road from the little farms of Hofa Park down through the wilderness to the church. Tough going, without horses, tough trees to cut for homes, tough land to clear for farming. A man had only his own two hands, a broad back and a stout heart. Folks in the town now still remember how it was. Val Białyszynski remembers the story of his father's coming, how his father came to survey the land, how he brought his wife and household goods to make a home in the timberland.
My dad, he was one of the first pioneers that came here to Pulaski. He had tough going. Well, I like all the rest of them, beginners. It was not like nowadays that you can get your stuff either through the rails or with the car. My dad, when he got married, he carried his kitchen stove 2 miles in parts on his back. And all the supplies, what they need, had to be carried from the closest store. Grocery store was 2 miles away. And all the clearing of the land, that was all done by hand. There was no tractors at that time, or even horses. They used oxen and stumps. I still remember how they pulled them with those stump pullers that were drawn by one horse, and an auger turning them stumps out, and some of them big pine stumps. It took them one day to pull one stump out and clear. So that was hard work.
Boy and man, they came to farm. And still alive today is one who came, a man grown not to farm, but ready to set up the first business enterprise in Pulaski. He's John Piplinski, pioneer.
This was wild country. This was nothing but brush and no roads, even nothing. Until the monastery started to build the convent here, and I used to have a logging road come through for 2 ladies.
Can you catch the words? They're worn with the years, more than half a century of remembering. But here they are for the record. And we young ones must listen carefully to catch the voices of our pioneers before they fade and are gone. Let's have John Piplinski tell us again.
This was wild country. This was nothing but brush and no roads, even nothing.
Thank you, John. You were the pioneer storekeeper, groceries and farm implements. And more than storekeeper and country merchant, you were a builder.
I organized a telephone line here, our own. I built a line from here to Angelica, 3.5 miles, myself.
That's the American way. One thing's done, do it yourself. One man can rig a telephone line. That line is still owned and run by an independent telephone man now. You, John, you went on to more business enterprises.
I built a cheese factory, and the cheese factory afterwards, I moved it away from here, from the corners, and I sold it afterwards. And now it's a big factory and running big, over 30,000 pounds of milk comes there. Yeah, daily. 1908, we organized the bank, and we had, but we didn't start in business. So we waited a year later because it was hard to get money then. It was hard times. And a year later, we opened up the bank. And we opened up at $16,000 at the house, because we didn't have no other building. So built in that's had in the front room of the house.
More of the American way, Wisconsin brand. A cheese factory and a market for the farmers around the town. As for the bank, no man doubted his money was safe with John Peplinski in the front room office at his house. Now that bank is worth $3 million. And John? Well, we interrupted John on his way out to an auction, going out to look over some property the bank is handling. He's a busy man still, no longer running the hardware store, but on the go every day.
I'm retired from the business, but I'm yet working for the bank. So I like to be busy. I always like to do something, because when I do something, I feel better.
How old are you now, sir?
I'll be 80 years in 10th of June.
Sales for the fiscal year of 1949 were $622,219, with net earnings of $37,600. And today the fixed assets are $85,500, and the total assets are $247,000.
The sound you heard back of those statistics is the sound of the cash register ringing up a sale in the Pulaski Chase Cooperative Store. Don't bother to remember the figures, but let them remind you that farming is big business in the life around Pulaski. From a small outfit in 1928, the farmer's co-op has grown to... But here's the farm store manager, Henry Wyszynski. Let him tell you.
Today, the Pulaski Chase Cooperative can fill most of the needs of the farmers, and it handles a complete line of farm machinery, parts, feeds, seeds, fertilizer, cement, oils and gasoline, locker service, and repairs of farm machinery.
Where does all the money come from? Not wheat, not corn, not even apple or cherry orchards. The money walks around on four legs in the shape of livestock: dairy cows, beef, hogs, and sheep. The market for livestock is 20 miles to the southeast, and down State Highway 32, the trucks are rolling every day of the week. One of those trucks carries Pulaski livestock to Green Bay. It belongs to the Shipping Association, another cooperative service to farmers, to market their goods straight to the packing plants without cutting profits with the middleman. Ask Mike Powers of the Shipping Association what it means to the farmer.
Whatever livestock he has is picked up and brought into Green Bay and sold, and the farmer gets exactly just what is brought on the market. There's no buyer getting any profit on that. Whatever the price is, that's what he gets, with just a small charge of trucking it in. We paid out to the farmers, after their expense was off, $403,652.18.
And just for the record, the Pulaski Shipping Association is the fifth largest in the state of Wisconsin. Period. But one thing leads to another. Old hands at cooperating, these same farmers join hands in still another farm organization with mutual benefits.
We started a little farm bureau of our own down here at Pulaski, comprising four townships. Organized the Pulaski, what is known as the Pulaski Farm Bureau. First of its kind in the United States. Set up with the setup that we had. They're ordinarily set up in counties.
I see.
And our counties around here were not organized, so we set it up here of our own here in four townships in three different counties. On a local basis, we have set up services for the members, more or less cooperatively, all of it. We've set up automobile insurance, we've set up farm supply, we've got our own fire and wind insurance today, our health and accident insurance, and we have our own life insurance company now.
That was Bill Zebarth, president of the Farm Bureau. Sound good to you? Too good, perhaps? Is this still the American way of life, farmers and neighbors pooling their affairs in cooperatives? What does that business do to the merchants, the retailers, the commercial life of Pulaski? We put the question to Ed Malcheski, one of the big farm leaders.
Years ago, we had some, some of them thought that the, for instance, that the co-ops would ruin business, but the facts are not such. The facts are that on account of the great expansion that the co-ops did for this community, it also increased the business for the whole village, and I think any businessman here has more business today than he would have had otherwise if we'd still had the little town that we had before.
Well, let's ask any businessman.
Let's ask the town's first storekeeper, the head of a family of businessmen, the town's banker, John Paplinski, the fine old pioneer we've met already. John, how are things between the farmers and the village?
Well, the village and the farmers are very good, and everything works hand in hand. We have never had any trouble or nothing. They're very good to the village, and so we are good to the farmers, because we make our living out of the farmers. That's the only way we make a living here. It's the farmers what makes it. When the farmers make good, we make good too.
Thank you, John. That bears repeating. When the farmers make good, we make good too. But did you ever hear of a fly in the ointment? A monkey wrench in the works? Something rotten in Denmark, and if it's a rotten apple, it can spoil the whole bushel? Let's take off our rosy glasses and take a hard look at Pulaski. There she lies, a trading center at the crossroads, encircled no longer by marshlands, the wilderness gone, erased by rich farmlands. But a village can die, like a man in the midst of plenty. Like a man with a sickness wasting away in spite of sunshine, shelter, and sustenance, so a village may shrink and shrivel away. The cold winds of commerce blow past it to larger centers. The lifeblood of population grow thin and spiritless. You've seen them. The ghost towns, dead but not resting in peace. A wide spot in the road where the traffic whizzes by, the speeding wheels not pausing on their way to big town beyond. Only the gas station does a steady business, and the dust settles on the storefronts and on the counters and shelves. The old folks still live in the scraggly line of houses, but the young folks move away, and the screened-in front porches droop with the memory. Yes, a village can die in the midst of plenty, in the midst of plenty on the farms around it. And in the 1930s, the village of Pulaski looked its death warrant in the face.
In 1937, we took a survey of all our high school graduates since 1923. And we found out where they were and what they were doing, and to our surprise, they weren't farming. Only 15 to 20% of them were farming and staying in a small town. 75 to 80% of them went to Chicago and Milwaukee and California and Oregon and Washington to find jobs. No community can continue to exist if it loses its best human resource.
That's Frank Joswick talking. He's the principal of Pulaski High School.
Another thing that our social science survey found out is that these young people have left town, and we have asked them why they left town, and there were three or four main answers. And one of them was because the community doesn't furnish enough recreational facilities. And then these young people in our survey told us that our community lacked community services such as waterworks, sewer service, some professional services, and some business services that were lacking in our small village of 1,000 people. And above all, these young people, almost to a one, 85 to 90% of them, that were questioned, and by the way, we questioned about 700 or 800 of them, almost 85% of them answered, I would have stayed in Pulaski if there were jobs available in that town. And then on top of that, we sent 400 questionnaires. Again, our social science classes did that to the boys in the armed forces, and they came back with the same answers. 280 of them answered, we'll come back to Pulaski if there is employment, if there are jobs.
Those were the facts, the fatal facts. And they looked at you with the eyes of a ghost town. But you don't face facts and then fold your hands. You don't say, I'm sick, and then lie down to die. You get a diagnosis, find out causes, then get busy on the cure. Throw behind it every ounce of your will to live. The folks of Pulaski had the will, and they found the cure.
And so let me tell you, people, we were so impressed with the statistics that we gathered and the surveys that we have taken and the questionnaires and the opinions that were given to us, that the whole community started to work on these problems. And these were the problems of school children, of teachers, of everybody. And so our students went out with these stories to the Chamber of Commerce and told them about it, to the American Legion, to church groups, to various organizations, to the village board members. And they told them just exactly what their findings were. People became conscious of the fact that what we need first of all is jobs, because that will keep young people at home. So we embarked upon the idea of attracting industry, and we did.
That's not the voice of a ghost town. Frank Joswicks is the voice of a town talking turkey, telling the world you can stay alive and prosper if everybody puts a shoulder to the wheel. They advertised throughout the state, contacted three young men who had the money to equip a shoe factory, but not enough for a building. They told those young men, "We'll build you a building, you start that business." And they did. They organized, adopted the name Pulaski Industries, sold shares at $100 apiece to finance the building the shoe factory needed to settle in the town.
We organized a committee. They went out and got subscriptions.
From whom?
From businessmen, from farmers, from laborers, and even some of the veterans as they came in, pitched in. We got a jackpot together of about $30,000.
That's Bernard Lundkowski, cashier of the bank. Banker and bulwark of town affairs. Businessman in a business suit. But under his coat are shirt sleeves ready to be rolled up for the job. And in the winter of 1945, the job was to get the factory building up.
We had to have it up for them sometime early in the spring. Spring of 1946. So we started in 1945, and a lot of that building was done in the wintertime. One of the funny things that happened there, for instance, was we're putting on a roof, and it was just about dead winter. And Mr. Joswig hired a stove to heat up asphalt or just tar that they use on roofs. And it was necessary for him to be there about once each 2 hours to load the stove up with kerosene. So I don't know how many nights he'd come down to the factory throughout the night to load the stove up with this kerosene. Well, that's just one of the incidents. You can imagine men who didn't have any training in building, all pitching in to put this factory building up. Fellows like Kubiak, who runs a garage, and Bill Sheedy, who's a contractor, and Edward Liss, who's with the Standard Oil Company, fellows who you wouldn't expect anything like that from, would be in there digging away with a shovel and pick and helping to move blocks.
In the dead of winter?
In the dead of winter.
How much did you say that paid for it?
Well, there was no pay. You did that for nothing. But just to get this building up, and that, sometimes you wonder.
Yep, sometimes you wonder. You wonder if they're listening, the faint of heart, those who are afraid in 1950. You wonder if they get the big idea, what free men can do in a democracy. Do they understand this in all the United States, in all hemispheres, in all the frightened corners of the earth where men wring their hands and say, "We are little men, what can we do?" Have they tried this American way?
The operation and the manufacture of shoes begin with the cutting. The skins are brought into the cutters, and the clickers are started in the left to our left here. We cut these shoes with dies.
This is the shoe factory. Men and women and machines at work. Lloyd Johnson, the plant superintendent, is showing us around.
Various parts out first. Then they go from the cutters, they go to what they call the fitting department, where they fit and skive and start assembling these pieces. Various sizes, and the sizes are stamped on them. We have about 125 to 30 girls. It's in this department that does the sewing, the stitching these shoes together.
If the machines were quieter, you could catch the sound of music in the background. For this is a cheerful factory with a friendly atmosphere, with light and music to brighten the workday. The factory makes shoes for children, little folks up to the junior miss. Piles of leather, black and brown, white leather for infant shoes and for youngster summer parties. We are no experts on the shoe business, but we like the looks of the finished products. The rows of shoes lined up here on the racks, ready for the retail stores. We take note of what the plant superintendent says about his crew, about the job of the workers here in the factory.
Each operator in the factory has his own part to play in the manufacture of shoes. Each one has an operation to do. Every operator in here has to do their part, and they're on the part that's done on the shoe, so it will go, and will not damage the shoe. That's why it is important that we keep and maintain a good force at all times.
Keep and maintain a good force at all times. Responsible workers, conscientious labor supply. That's one thing factory management looks for and must find before an industry can get started in a town. We want the rest of the picture. So we go to Paul Gilkerson in another part of the factory. Mr. Gilkerson is one of the three owners of the Northern Shoe Company. We want him to tell us why he and his partners came to Pulaski to set up shop.
Well, the Northern Shoe Company was conceived in the minds of three people who wanted to go in the shoe business. Some of us were from Milwaukee and some from Chicago. Mr. Coppins was from Modern Shoe Company in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, and Mr. Ludwig was an attorney in Milwaukee. And we decided to open this little factory about early in 1945, and we decided we wanted to open it in Wisconsin because that was our home state for the most part. We canvassed the state for a location. We came upon Pulaski, and we were quite impressed with Mr. Joswick's theories of balancing agricultural income with industrial income to give the farmers cash income. We chose a small town because we feel that you're closer to your people understand your problem more, and the people themselves are more independent, usually through their farm interests.
We talked to some of the employees, some of the factory workers. We get a line on what Mr. Gilkerson means about hiring farmers to work in industry.
In the morning, I milk cows and clean barn and do all the farm work, and do most of the hard work, and then in the after work, then I do the rest.
I see. You pretty well take care of the farm yourself.
Well, quite a bit. My dad helps me, and my wife helps me quite a bit, though, too.
That was Dick Baranchek.
My name is Suzanne Leith. I am shoe inspector. Well, I live out in the country. We are retired, and we are working here in the shoe factory.
You are retired, as far as the farm's concerned.
That's right. As far as the farm is concerned,
is the farm
retired.
The farm operated all?
Yes, it's operated by my son.
And another young farmer, Dominic Kuchkevich.
Well, I take care of. I help out my dad on the farm here. We run a dairy in town. We just started our pasteurizing now. Get up around 6 o'clock and go to the barn and do as much as I can, and then I come here to work. I put a full day of work in here and come back home and get out to the barn, help around with the chores in the barn, and take care of the part of the milk crowd. And Saturdays, if my dad needs me around, I deliver milk for him or help him around as much as possible.
What do you do for recreation?
Oh, I do a lot of bowling. In summertime, I play a lot of ball, especially softball. And we have been taking championships for 3 years.
Time and energy enough left over from work to take off with a championship ball team. That's something to remember in the spring of 1950. A footnote to add to the American way of life. It's not all work and no play. And for factory management, too, there comes a time when business slacks off, the seasonal slump of the year. We want to know the story here, and we ask Paul Gilkerson again.
The worst part of our seasonal slump is usually comes in October. Last August, Mr. Joswick brought to our attention the fact that there wasn't enough help available in the area to permit the local canning factory here to operate and at a full crew so that they could take in the farmers' crops in the immediate area. So it was suggested that we voluntarily slow down our production during this period so some of our help would be available to help the canning factory. Now, that's a situation that could only be found in a town of this size. I'm sure you couldn't find that degree of cooperation in a city.
Now, here's the big question. Does it pay off? This rosy, cooperative, friendly industry in a farm village, can you prove an ideal in dollars and cents? Can you balance it with business and keep it out of the red?
Our business has grown to approximately twice the planned size of the business, and it's just a question of needing more space so we can make more shoes and employ more people.
There's Paul Gilkerson's answer. A simple, dry, business-like answer. American industry expanding. Free enterprise. Well, so Northern Shoe Company needs more space.
That's Paul Gilkerson's current headache, a new building. And the townspeople figure it's their worry, too. So now, as in the winter of 45 and 46, the folks of Pulaski are investing in industry, in their own jobs, in the future of their village. And Frank Joswick, the school principal, is in the thick of the drive.
The community council, for the purpose of expanding our industrial development, write that at the present time we're in the midst of a campaign to raise $35,000 for an addition to our present factory. But in addition to that, we are also keeping in mind that one factory and one industry is not sufficient, although this one employs over 300 people. To diversify, we plan on attracting other industries, small industries, so as to give people an opportunity to use their various aptitudes and talents and abilities in other industries, and also for the purpose of providing a better and sounder tax base and community economy.
And speaking of tax base, let's pause here to say that in Pulaski, as of now, the tax base has gone up from $800,000 to $3 million. Just thought you'd like to know. Pretty good for a village under 1,000 population. And that annual American annoyance, paying taxes. Well, Pulaski's tax rate is one of the lowest in the state. For the schools, it is down from 15 to 10 mils. 10 mils of the tax dollar get Pulaski one of the finest schools in Wisconsin. Here's the high school band in action, Jerry Parker directing. If in the beginning publicity brought the church and the church brought people to Pulaski, now the high school carries Pulaski's name to fame in every corner of the state and nation. It's the largest rural high school in Wisconsin with a reputation as big as all outdoors. Everywhere in Wisconsin, when teachers, school administrators meet, they say, "How about Pulaski? How does it work?" Across the state to the southwest at Platteville State Teachers College, they recently asked Frank Joswick to give the answers. Here's part of his speech to the Community Leaders Conference.
The school and the community are inseparable. One of the important reasons why we have schools, and I think institutions such as churches, and organizations such as governments, is for the purpose of preserving civilization and improving it. And the school, therefore, ought to act as an agency in improving that civilization or that community, that particular area in which it serves. I don't believe that there is any reason why we should have a stove or a heating system in the house in the wintertime unless it generates some heat. For that same reason, I don't believe that we should have any business having any kind of a school in a community unless it improves and preserves civilization in that community.
While their school principal was giving that platform speech, the kids back home in Pulaski were getting out their newspaper. It's the only local newspaper in the town, and senior high school kids in the journalism class do the reporting and writing, and the typing classes lend a hand. The boys and girls get advertising, too, enough to cover the costs of printing. The happy subscribers who get the newspaper pay only a buck a year.
The Pulaski News, as it is today, was first published in August 1942 and was the outgrowth of the Pulaski High News, the official school paper, which was started in 1937.
That's Larry Martin, the debater, boxer, member of FFA and the 4-H Club, elected vice president of the senior class and executive editor of the newspaper. Larry reads from the record.
From this very humble beginning, the 4-page paper with a circulation of only high school students grew into an 8-page paper with 2,000 subscribers and serving the entire Pulaski community. Pulaski News has taken definite stands on several important issues and has helped to promote the municipal sewer and water system for the village of Pulaski, bring in a new industry, the Northern Shoe Company, promote a recreation program for the community, and help with Red Cross and community chest drives.
It's a woman's world, too, in the high school. Item in the Pulaski News about the home economics classes, quote,
the home ec classes are studying about electricity. Electricity is of great importance to the homemaker, and if something goes wrong, she might have to make her own repairs. Also, the girls in the classes have been making floor plans of their homes and remodeling them to better planned rooms.
That article was written by Betty Brefchinsky, blonde, blue-eyed senior, 5 feet, 4 inches tall. She and 120 other girls make up 6 daily classes in home economics, full of practical projects like electrical repairs and tasty jobs like preparing meals for adult visitors to the school. The girls' teacher is Miss Dorothy Keenan, who still has time to give to women in the community who come to the school for sewing classes at night. Teacher says it's all part of her job.
Well, most of these women haven't had the benefit of any organized instruction in sewing, so they like information on some of the new techniques, like putting in zippers and using patterns and ways of finishing necklines, and that's what I try to do mostly.
And the projects they work on are actual practical projects?
Yes, they sew clothes for themselves and a lot of them for their children. Many of them have small children and they're interested in making clothes for them.
Listen for a moment to the Girls' Glee Club. Yes, it's a lullaby song by the Girls' Glee Club, 40 strong, under the direction of Jerry Parker. But around the corner, it's a man's job on the hammer and saw for high school boys in shop class. The boys are building a house. Not a miniature model, a real house. A two-story house on an empty lot about a block away from the school. When it's finished, the highest bidder will get it at auction, and some lucky family will have the answer to the housing problem. Now the frame is up and the floor is in, and we ask the boys to knock off work and tell us the story. Here's Eugene Naparella.
My name is Eugene Naparella. Well, right now we're putting in a furnace, and it's a coal-burning forced air furnace, and we're putting in the registers, both the hot and cold air, and then some of the other boys are putting in insulation.
And we climb up to the second floor to get a word with Jerry Truskowski.
We're putting up insulation right now.
The insulation. What kind of insulation are you using?
It's fiberglass blanket insulation.
What other work have you done on the house?
Well, we've built the whole house from bottom to top almost.
I say we climbed up to get a word with him. Well, you don't get many words from teenage house builders, but the house speaks for itself. And the boy's teacher, Mr. Eugene Wielgus, fills in the story.
We try to work for 3 definite principles. We like the knowing angle, the doing angle, and the being. Now, usually, the knowing angle is overstressed. At least we feel so in Pulaski. And so we've been trying a little more on this line of doing, actual doing, bringing out the art in the industry and the industrial arts picture.
And who pays the bills for the shop classes to build a house?
The building itself is being financed through the school board as a regular school project, just as any other project would be financed. A small end table or a desk or almost any other project which a person would be working on, a student, that is.
But let's remember that Pulaski's a farm community, and many boys here will grow up to be farmers. They're studying it now with Emil Vandermos, vocational agriculture instructor. He's on hand, too, supervising the house-building project. But how does building a house tie in with vocational agriculture?
The boys get many variations in their work. They learn how to mix concrete, which is one of the things that I have to teach them. They have to know how to cut rafters before they leave the shop class. That is, they have to learn that at some time during the year. They have to know a little something, especially in this community, about laying concrete blocks. Well, all of those things tie in pretty well here with this project of building this house. One thing I stressed a lot this year was the milk testing program. The boys bring their samples of milk in from each cow and test the milk, and they actually figure out the records on their herd. That is, they have some idea of which are their good cows and which are their poor ones.
You have the testing equipment in the school?
That's right. We have a testing room that is pretty well equipped for doing that work. Along with the testing, I might mention the fact that we also have facilities there to test soil for the farmers in the community. We're getting to this time of the year where we're going to do a lot of testing of soil. As soon as the frost gets out of the ground, the boys start bringing samples of soil in, and I might say that will be a pretty busy laboratory.
Well, the frost is coming out of the ground now, friend, and testing soil, breaking it with the plow, and spring planting time is upon us. Good things for American farm boys to be learning about in their schoolrooms. Better still, in the spring of 1950 is the idea of youngsters learning what community life is all about, what goes on in their hometown, and what job they can do in it. 40 boys and girls get high school credit for working part-time in offices and stores in town. Their school principal sets it up as give and take.
We take a lot of interest in the community, the students and teachers. The community, however, reciprocates and takes a lot of interest in us. Our students, for instance, go uptown for various purposes. They visit stores, they visit factories, they visit farm organizations. Many of them attend the village board meetings. They write it up for their student newspaper, by the way, which is the only newspaper in the community. We also invite people from the community to come into the school, visit classes, and talk to students as resource leaders. We have a doctor this week, for instance. Last week we had a lawyer. The week before we had a social security expert, and we have a farmer. We have a banker on our programs. People from the community or from the surrounding area.
Doctor, lawyer, merchant, chief. Oh, yes, and we ought to include the American athlete. Plenty of them in Pulaski. Remember back in the survey where people said they wanted job opportunities and more recreation? Well, they're breaking ground now for a new gym auditorium at the high school for grown-ups and youngsters to share alike. Already there's plenty of recreation on the old fairground. But before the warm summer breezes blow across the softball field and play around the picnic tables in the horseshoe pitching area, there are the long winter nights and the sound of bowling balls crashing down the alley at the Palace Recreation Hall. The wives of men on the bowling teams don't complain on tournament nights. The women have a chance at their own handicap sweepstakes. And we talk to a family man.
Married? I'm married. Family? I have a girl in high school.
I see.
Is it a good place for kids? Why, it is the best town in Wisconsin for youngsters.
The best town in Wisconsin for youngsters. That was Bernard Lundkowski. You remember him. Cashier at the bank, who told us how the fellows all worked, putting up the factory building in the dead of winter. Now meet another businessman with a family, glad to make a living in Pulaski and enjoy some fun, too. His name, Matt Kopreski.
I have a furniture store here in town. We're here going on the fifth year. Came from Chicago.
From Chicago? Well, why'd you come to Pulaski?
Because we thought a nice small town is a place to live, which we found out was really a nice place to live in and enjoy life the way you should enjoy it.
And you're happy here?
Very happy.
You plan to move back to the big city at all?
Not unless to take a team of horses to drag us back there.
The fellow's kid, Matt, when we ask him about his bowling. His team's in last place. Lucian Kravchek's on the same team. He's president of the Chamber of Commerce and owns the Model Bakery and Grocery Store. Glad to be in Pulaski because...
because it's one of the best communities in Wisconsin as far as business is concerned. The local trading area is very prosperous and business is always good when the farmers are doing good. Why, we all do good.
Takes us back to John Piplinski, the sturdy pioneer. When the farmers do good, we all do good. There's Jim Brusky on his accordion again. Plays the Polish song, Strong and Gay. clean-cut American boy with a fine education, living in a good town, that's alive, prosperous, that's not enough. Not enough for kids growing up like Jim Brusky. Not enough for the Chamber of Commerce or the farm co-op or the shoe industry. You don't take what you've got in your home territory and put a fence around it and say, this is mine, this is my world. The song Jim played came from across the seas. So did the names on the mailboxes. So did the spirit that cleared the wilderness. So did the faith that built the church. The real substance of humanity that makes good living here is the birthright of all men in all corners of the earth. Citizens of Pulaski are also citizens of the world. We want you to know about that kind of citizenship. It means sticking your neck out of the little town where you were born. Means doing a job wherever you're needed, where less fortunate people are in trouble. Out in Ed Malcheski's barn at 7 o'clock in the morning, we talk to Ed about these things. Milking's over, and Harry Laskuski, the hired man, is cleaning up the barn. Ed tells us what the whole town already knows.
In 1945, when the United Nations, or rather the UNRWA department, needed people to go over there, the Poland, to do some work, I happened to be chosen. Of course, it is the University again of Wisconsin that recommended me over there, and they sent me over there, and I spent 2 years over there on the agricultural department. I had charge of the farm machinery. Our main object was there to bring production, because there was millions of acres that were not touched over there, and of course, over half of the horses, over a million and a half of the horses were destroyed. Therefore, them people had no power at all. So I went up there with the tractors. I had 8,800 tractors over there working in that area to get them back into production.
Ed is 62 years old, has 9 children. One of his boys is married and a student in the university. Ed was given the Master Farmer Award by the Wisconsin College of Agriculture a little while back. He was one of the original stockholders in Pulaski Industries. And he's just bought some more shares for the new building. You're right, you say. Ed Malcheski's an exception. Not every farmer in America's apt to pull off to Europe and worry about folks in trouble over there. But hundreds of farmers everywhere are getting the same idea Ed did.
When I was over there, I realized that millions of them people couldn't go back over there, and I felt that people in this country should take our share of them, and so I felt I could use them on my farm, and therefore I took a family.
Mother and father, a family of 5 children. Ed Malcheski brought these displaced persons to Pulaski, got them on his farm and on jobs hired out to neighbors. Other new arrivals from Europe work in the shoe factory. Shirley Tim, a high school senior, recently heard from her pen pal in Austria through the school letter exchange club. There's room, elbow room, for world citizenship ideas. Nobody's put a fence around Pulaski. So it goes, life on Main Street in the spring of 1950. Oh, yes. One more thing before we forget. A word from the man much concerned with life. With life and well-being from birth all down the long road. One of the 3 village doctors in Pulaski is Dr. McDermott. We found him in the prescription room of Ken Hendershot's drugstore. Dr. McDermott, what's the report on health?
The health, as a general picture, is good. There have been no epidemics of any serious degree the past few years. Polio cases have been few. Many people in this area live to an advanced age, active into their late 80s, more so than many communities of this size. The mental health picture in this area is considerably better, I believe, than in larger communities. This may be held accountable to the fact that people in this area are active, even in the older age groups, that small-town life on the farm, while strenuous, is not as nerve-wracking. There is not as much tension and strain as in cities of a larger population.
A long life and a healthy one. Thriving town at the crossroads. An airport, a railroad. No dust on the counters and shelves of Norbert Paplinski's hardware store. Traffic stops at Orville Kubiak's woodwork shop. Old John at the bank's ready to lend money to young folks who want to buy a house and settle down. Dick Pfeiffer, with his dry cleaning pickup business, services the community for 60 miles around. Miss Bremer's going on her 28th year of teaching in the grade school, and Ed Johnson, the rural postman, has carried the mail for more than 30 years. Knows all those names on the mailboxes we mentioned. It's a good life, the way Pulaski folks live it. What they've built here, they built with their own hands and a stout heart. Take it from Frank Joswick.
I believe that this is a much better way than to look for handouts from Washington or even from Madison. I believe that this is the American way, and that's God's way.
Profile of Pulaski, Wisconsin. This has been the fourth in a series of documentary programs about the people and places of Wisconsin. Script by J. Helen Stanley. Your narrator-producer was Ray Stanley. Join us in 2 weeks for a profile of the city of Eau Claire. This is the Wisconsin College of the Air.